next song doesn't go something like this. It goes exactly like this. Eddie was a friend of mine. He was killed playing checkers. You know that term, king me? The other guy wasn't sure what he said. Phil's a friend of mine. And he was killed walking into a walk-in closet. He was walking way too fast and way too far.
Academy Award-winning and Grammy-nominated comedian Stephen Wright will perform at The Egg in Albany on October 1st. Wright's career has been expanded to albums, film, and television experiences with his deadpan style. He's been a staple in the entertainment scene for more than three decades. He was nominated for an Emmy Award as a producer for the hit FX series Louie. And in 1989, he received an Academy Award for Best Live Action Short Film for The Appointments of Dennis Jennings. It is a great pleasure to welcome Stephen Wright to the roundtable this morning. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us. Very nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's very nice to have you on the program. It's always nice to have you on the program. So you're coming to The Egg. You're doing this. You're doing a lot of dates this fall, from what I can see.
Well, I go out, you know, I do sporadic, do two or three, then go home and go out and do two or three like that. That's what I do all year.
Where's home for you these days?
I live in Carlisle, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. So you're East Coast. And so do you like that? Is that much better than being in the West Coast, being in L.A., and that life?
Well, I lived there for like 13 years, and I never felt at home there. I was mainly doing stand-up, I'm from New England, and I just wanted to go back. Like, I lived in New York City, I lived in Hollywood, then I lived back in Santa Monica, and I wanted to go home, so I went back to Massachusetts about 12 years ago. And I love it. I love the seasons, and I love all my family being there and everything. It's a great move.
Your style, as I said in the introduction, that deadpan style, do you think that that is at all reflective of your New England roots?
No, I don't. I don't think it, because most people I know don't talk like this. My brother talks like this, but I don't think it's connected at all, really.
But a reserve, where New Englanders often refer to as a reserved folk. Do you consider yourself reserved?
I'm reserved, but I never connected it to New England in general. I mean, the people I know, especially the comedians in Boston, none of them are reserved.
When you started out, were there people advising you not to do what ultimately became your signature style?
No, because the beauty of starting in Boston was there was nobody to advise you. There was no age. There was no show business there. It was the stage performing in the clubs, but there was no managers or producers or agents or anybody to say anything to you. Everyone was learning on their own. We all started kind of at the same time in 1979, and there was no one to say anything like that.
In 79, 1980, who were you starting with? Who were your peers at that point?
I was starting with Mike McDonald, Mike Donovan, Dennis Leary, Kevin Meaney, Paula Poundstone, Barry Crimmins, Bobcat Goldthwait, Steve Sweeney, Don Gavin. Every one of those people I named is completely different than each other. It was really a great time. It was like we were on an island. We were very isolated and learning our craft.
And learning that craft wasn't, of course, just in Boston. You were still going around to clubs across the country, right?
No, well, not till I went on TV. I started in 79, and then I went on The Tonight Show in 82. But those 3 years was always in Boston and Cambridge and maybe down in Providence. Very local.
when you went on The Tonight Show, of course, this is, you know, so many people talk about this, of how that moment changes their life. Was that the case for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I wanted to go on there since I was 16. One of the reasons I wanted to be a comedian, the main reason, was watching Johnny Carson, watching George Carlin and Robert Klein and Richard Pryor and all these comedians coming on there. That's why I even got it into my head. And then when I started in the clubs, and one of the producers came to Massachusetts to look at colleges, because his producers of The Tonight Show, because his kids were getting out of high school, so they made a summer trip to Massachusetts and New York to look at colleges, and he went into one of the clubs, and he saw me on stage, and then 2 weeks later, I was on The Tonight Show. It was like a fairy tale. His name is Peter LaSalle. He changed my whole life. I mean, I went on that show. I had no agent, no manager, nothing, and then that 1 6 minutes changed everything.
When you did that, you killed. I mean, you did really, really well. Did it feel like it at the time?
It was the most surreal thing I've ever done in my life, because, like I said, I was watching the show since I was 16, and then there I am backstage. I got so nervous that I wasn't nervous anymore. I was numb. And then I came out and I started telling the jokes, and the audience started laughing, just like in the clubs. I mean, the audience had 500 people in it. Even if it didn't go on television, that was the biggest crowd I had ever played to, because the clubs only had like 180 or 200 people. And then I heard Johnny Carson laughing to my right, and I was like, oh my God, this is unbelievable.
About 4 years ago, it was yesterday. Couldn't sleep, so I got up. Then I got hungry, so I went out to the store that I know is open 24 hours. When I got down there was a guy outside locking it up. He said, sorry, we're closed. I said, what do you mean you're closed? The sign says open 24 hours. He said, not in a row.
And then I just kept doing the set, and they laughed, and then he called me over, and I sat down, and still to this day, all the things I've done, all those things you mentioned when you introduced me, still my favorite thing is going on that show the first time. That's the highlight of my career.
You said it was surreal, but can you even put into words what it was like from finishing your set to walking over to the couch next to Johnny Carson?
Well, they told me before that when I was done, I should turn around and go back through the curtain. Like, so when I was done, there were guys in front of me, you know, with headphones on, like, you know, they run the stage. They were motioning me to go over to sit down. So I was confused because I was told one thing. And I went over there and I sat down. I mean, if you Google that, you look at that. I was 26. I couldn't even talk. He's asking me questions, and I'm stammering all over the place.
Did they just let you out for this evening?
Yeah, I have an hour left.
That's wonderfully inventive stuff.
Thanks.
Really? Is this your first time on
first
national
time
television?
On national television, yes.
Yeah. How do you feel about it?
What? I'm in shock.
Did it go the way you thought it would go?
Yeah, yep. Yeah.
Not a lot of comedians don't come out of Boston.
No, there's a lot of good ones there, and they're with me right now in my head.
Where do you work in Boston?
I work at the Comedy Connection and Constant Comedy, which is in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And that's where Peter LaSalle saw me, who...
That's right.
He got me here, and he saw me. He didn't say anything, but 3 weeks later, the phone rang, and he said, how'd you like to do The Tonight Show? And I said, I think you have the wrong number.
I was like a little kid. I was frightened as hell.
Hmm. You've always been, are you more comfortable when you're just doing your set on stage, I assume, than when you are in, well, even a setting like this, but when you're in a setting on a national talk show talking to the host?
Yeah, because on stage, I've been going doing it for so many years. Like, that's just, I've been doing that since 79, and I'm familiar with that. But I've done so many talk shows now that the talking to the host, that's a whole other little act. It's almost like you have you're in a temporary partnership with whoever the host is. It's like a little play, and it's different, of course, than the stand-up.
Right.
It's different in the sense you can tell stories and you can get away with more because it doesn't have to be a very exact joke. You can just be conversational and tell more insane stories to the person than you could if you was facing the audience.
I was just telling this story, but I teach an interviewing class, and I play for my students the interview that you did with Bob Costas on a show on NBC called Later. And it was one of those moments where he just seemed completely befuddled, didn't know what to do with you, and finally just turned to you and said, "Hey, be funny."
He did? What did I do?
You were funny. Although it was very awkward, I can't deny that.
It was extremely awkward because at the time, I mean, I was like 26 to 27. I didn't know that it didn't matter what you said as long as you kept talking. So when he asked me a question, I would give him a very direct 2 or 3 word answer, right? Isn't that how it went?
Yes.
You know, how did you like being in Boston starting out? I'm making this up. I can't even remember. How do you like being in Boston? It's good. I like it. You know, now I would say it's good. I like it. A lot of comedians. He actually went on Letterman after that a few months later and said to the audience that I was the hardest interview he had ever done.
Yes.
Because of that interview you just said. But it was because I hadn't learned how to just talk about it, you know, just keep talking.
And
that's funny that you're playing that to the class. That's hilarious.
Oh, they learn a lot from it.
I tell my sister.
Yes. And I think
you're teaching them how to deal with, like, how to deal with this if this happens. Is that what you
teach? Well, yes, but also the absurdity of asking that question of just be funny. You know, I mean, that was sort of the point to me, was that I don't know how you then just turn it on and do that.
Yes, I don't. That's why I said, "What did I do?" Because I can't imagine. I must have told a joke.
Yes, and I assume that when you go on things like programs like this, and obviously you're going to be at the Egg, you want to sell tickets to the show, people want to come out and see you. But by the same token, people know your brand of comedy; they know what to expect. So it's a little bit different in this venue than it is when you're obviously on stage and you're in control.
Yeah, I mean, you mean as opposed to a talk show, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know everything. The show, being a stand-up to me, is that you're a writer and you're a performer. They're completely two separate things. So I essentially go out and I perform what I have written. To me, it's like a play. It's like, I mean, I know I'm changing the subject every 5 seconds and everything, but I know from the beginning right straight through to the end what's going to happen. Even if I'm trying out new material, I know where I'm going to try it out in the show.
And so is it stream of consciousness, or do you always know the order? Is this joke going to follow that joke, and then that joke will follow that one?
I used to do it off the top of my head, like I had a big Rolodex in my head.
Right.
And I used to pick them as I went along, and then I took a 6-month break. I don't remember why. This is like 15 years ago. I took a 6-month break, and when I went back to doing it, I was like, I didn't know how I was even doing that. I thought, this is insane. It will be much more relaxing for me if I know what I'm going to say next.
Yeah. Because
then I don't have to waste energy like trying to choose another joke. I can just perform each joke. What's that?
There was a point when you're on stage where you will hold your head, you'll hold your forehead, and it's as if you are thinking about what is coming next, which I assume over time has just become a part of the act.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about what I'm saying. I'm like thinking what's next. And the fact that I'm not even facing the audience almost gives me a little bit of a break almost. It's like a little 3-second break because I'm not even looking at them. Mm.
It's fun as an audience member to see when you, and it's very rare when you do it, but when you do break, when you smile or when you react in some way other than that deadpan.
Yeah, what happens is, I mean, when I think of the joke, I might laugh. Even when I think of it, I hardly ever laugh, maybe about 10, 20% of the time. So I think of it, then I write it down, so then I've heard it twice, then I memorize it. I've heard it 3 times and 4 times before I've even said it in front of an audience. But when I laugh up on stage, it's like because I'm seeing someone in the audience getting a real kick out of this insane thing that I thought of at 2 in the morning or something. So I'm laughing at how they're laughing at it. That's what you're describing.
And, of course, you have to give the audience almost a beat because so much of your comedy is you really do have to think it through sometimes. I mean, that can be a quick process, but still, there's more thinking involved, and so you almost wait that beat for them to catch up with you.
Yes, some of the jokes are very, very simple, and other ones are like little gymnastics, like little mental gymnastics, like I give them A and B, and they have to put in C in order to get to the D, meaning the punchline. So they're little puzzles sometimes, and that's why there's what you described.
Do you, with the new material that you're working on, and even what we'll hear on October 1st, do you get political at all? Do you even think about things like that?
No, right from the beginning, right when I made all these rules up for myself, right before I even went on stage, I thought I'm not going to talk about some giant thing in the public eye, like the presidency, or I'm not going to talk about a famous TV show, or I'm not going to talk about a famous actor, I'm not going to talk about McDonald's, I'm not going to swear. I swear a little bit now, but I wasn't going to swear. I wasn't going to do jokes at anybody's expense. And you know, at the time when I started, HBO was just starting, so I didn't want to. If I ever got the opportunity to go on the Tonight Show, I didn't want to build up material, a lot of it that I couldn't even say because I was swearing. And I also noticed that if you swore during a joke, like a joke on a scale of 1 to 10, like a 6, if you swore during the joke, it would get an 8 reaction. You just insert any swear you want into this theory. And I didn't want, I wanted it, the joke to get the real reaction of what was, the, you know, the idea I was talking about. I didn't want right. the jokes to be attached to time. Like I'm talking about the speed of light and lint. I wanted to be able to do the joke as long as I wanted. So no, I won't be talking about the insane presidency. I can't believe how many people are in the United States. 380 million people, something like that.
Yes.
And it comes down to these two people. It's fascinating. It's just fascinating. I think they'd be better off if just a motorcade drove up through like Kansas or something, and a guy was painting his barn. He's up on a ladder, and they had a megaphone. Said, "Excuse me, you are now the next president." I mean, I think that would be better than going through all this stuff. This is nuts.
Do you ever allow yourself on stage to do what you just did, to come out of the character and to expound on different things, not political necessarily, but just about life versus the one line and the verbal gymnastics that you described?
No, I will do that on a talk show, but I've never, I've done it a little bit like on stage, but it never goes as well as the what I've written. Like I did some stuff about that. Remember that when they shot that gorilla and the little kid when it
where the child went down and yes,
Yeah, they shot him, and then I was saying I think they should replace the gorilla. That kid should be in that where the gorilla was, because I would pay to see a little kid who caused the death of a 700-pound gorilla. You know, I said that, but it didn't go as good as my jokes. So very rarely do I do that.
Well, you're going to be at the Egg on the 1st of October, and it's going to be great to have you in town, and great to have you on stage. Stephen Wright, a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, Academy Award-winning and Grammy-nominated comedian Stephen Wright will perform at the Egg in Albany on October 1st. You can find out more information about the performance by going to theegg.org, theegg.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.